This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 288 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hello, Max. How's your week been?
David, very good. Busy, but after all the travel, getting back into the swing of things, ready to go with another episode of the UAV Digest.
Yeah, we got a lot of FAA news, so I guess we should jump in and get started. What do you think?
All right, let's jump right in, David.
Our first story comes from avweb.com. FAA implements new recreational drone restrictions. This is from our buddy Brad Mazzari, and this hit the Federal Register on May 17th, 2019. So we're a little late on this, but what's going on, Max?
Well, what they published was the exception for limited recreational operations of unmanned aircraft. So what's that all about? Well, the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2018 repealed the special rule for model aircraft. It was replaced with a number of conditions that are required for people who want to operate recreationally small unmanned aircraft without requirements for FAA certification or operating authority. And so there's 8 statutory conditions that have to be met. However, there's a little bit of a twist to this, which is that the FAA cannot implement all of them immediately. Some can be, but some need more work before they can be implemented. So the exception they published here describes those 8 conditions that have to be met. And where they cannot be met at the present time, they lay out what is acceptable in the interim. So maybe, David, we can go through those 8 conditions quickly and maybe talk about the ones where the exception is going to apply for the time being.
Okay. Rule number 1, common sense. The aircraft is flown strictly for recreational purposes. My co-host commented on that one's easy. I'm not sure that the common sense thing is really that easy, but we'll give it the fact that if you're flying a recreational drone, you're flying it for recreational purposes. If you're not, don't do that.
Right. And you can't mix them. So in other words, if a flight has a recreational component and a non-recreational component to it, well, then the whole flight is non-recreational. So just something to keep in mind. The second condition is the aircraft is operated in accordance with or with the programming of a community-based organization's set of safety guidelines. And here's the part that's a little bit different, that are developed in coordination with the FAA. Well, the Act requires the FAA to establish guidelines for recognizing community-based aeromodeling organizations. They call that CBOs, community-based organizations. And those guidelines don't exist yet, but the FAA is working on them. After the guidelines are established, then the FAA can coordinate with recognized CBOs. But until the guidelines or the definition of what makes a recognized CBO is established, there can be no coordination. So on the face of it, we can't comply with that rule at this point in time. But the FAA has some accommodations that they'll make. Until the CBOs are recognized, they will allow, quote, operations conducted in accordance with existing safety guidelines of an aeromodeling organization. So in effect, it kind of sounds, David, like they're saying that the rules have changed a little bit. They have to coordinate with these organizations. But until that can happen, it's kind of like the way it used to be. So that's an exception. But now it gets a little bit more complicated in that there's an alternative to that, which is that if you follow the basic safety guidelines on the FAA.gov/UAS site, that's sufficient. So you have an option there. Follow the FAA guidelines or the existing safety guidelines of an aero modeling organization, which essentially means the AMA. But the last little twist to it is that you should be able to explain, and this is how the FAA states it, you should be able to explain to an FAA inspector or law enforcement official which safety guidelines you are following if you're flying under this exception for limited recreational unmanned aircraft operations. So it's kind of a little bit confusing, but it is an interim direction from the FAA.
Number three, the aircraft is flown within the visual line of sight of the person operating the aircraft or a visual observer co-located and in direct communication with the operator. The visual observer is optional unless flying FPV, and the operator can't see the surroundings.
All right, so that one's not too complicated. The next one is also easy. Number four is the aircraft is operated in a manner that does not interfere with and gives way to any manned aircraft. That obviously is something that can be implemented immediately.
Number five, in Class B, Class C, or Class D airspace, otherwise known as controlled airspace, or within the lateral boundaries of a surface area of Class E airspace designated for an airport, the operator obtains prior authorization from the administrator or designee before operating and complies with all aerospace restrictions and prohibitions.
So this means getting authorization through LANTS, right? The low altitude authorization and notification capability. That's the direction that's going. The FAA says that they are currently upgrading LANTS to enable recreational flyers to obtain automated authorization to controlled airspace. And they're committed, they say, to quickly implementing that for recreational flyers. But because it's not available at this moment, then the FAA is granting temporary airspace authorizations to operate at certain fixed sites, commonly referred to as flying fields, that are established by an agreement with the FAA. So during this interim period, you can fly in controlled airspace, but only at authorized fixed sites. And then the list of those sites is available at the FAA's website.
Part six, Class G airspace, otherwise known as uncontrolled. The aircraft is flown from the surface not more than 400 feet above ground level and complies with all airspace restrictions and prohibitions. Easy to say, stay away from the airport and fly below 400 feet.
Number seven is the operator has passed, and again, these are the eight requirements as a result of the reauthorization, but the requirement is the operator has passed an aeronautical knowledge and safety test and maintains proof of test passage to be made available to the administrator or a designee of the administrator or law enforcement upon request. Okay, there is no test right now. The FAA is currently developing a test. So the exception for the meantime is that recreational flyers who adhere to the other seven conditions may use this exception for limited recreational unmanned aircraft operations. So basically it's saying that the ultimate requirement is to have a test, a knowledge and safety test, but we don't have that now. So as long as you adhere to these other conditions, that's okay for now.
And last, number eight, the aircraft is registered and marked and proof of registration is made available to the administrator or designee of the minister or law enforcement upon request. Registration and marking requirements are published. Online registration process is in place. And the FAA says, quote, each unmanned aircraft used for limited recreational operations must display the registration number on an external surface of the aircraft. Proof of registration must be available on request.
All right, so there you have it. We have new operating rules here for recreational aircraft, some of which can be implemented, are implemented currently by the FAA. Others require some work to be done. So we have some exceptions that are allowable, and they're spelled out there. So we'll have a link to this, of course, in the show notes where you can dive into this in more detail. We actually just kind of skimmed the surface of it. There's much more text for each of these that describes them in greater detail. So if this applies to you as a recreational flyer, I would suggest that you take a look at this on your own and make sure you understand how the FAA wants you to interpret this. There's our FAA segment, David.
Sometimes they get longer and longer, but should we move on?
Yes.
Sniffer drones will start patrolling the world's busiest shipping ports. This is from Bloomberg.com. There are new regulations that apply to air pollution from ships, specifically sulfur oxide. Sniffer drones are being tested and used in ports all around the world. Well, what's a sniffer drone, Max?
The idea is that a drone would be flown through the plume of exhaust emitted by the ships and the readings taken in order to see if the sulfur oxide levels exceed some threshold. Now, as the article points out, if that's the case, that the levels as determined by the sniffer drone are in excess, that doesn't necessarily mean that the ship or the shipping owners can be charged with that. What that means is that they will then be able to target that ship to have its fuel tested to ascertain with certainty whether or not there's a violation. But there are a number of ports around the world, as you said, David, that are either operating these kinds of drones or are testing or planning for them. Hong Kong and Shenzhen are testing drones. I like the Netherlands here, David, is preparing what they're calling a super drone that can travel over 10 miles from the shore. So that sounds like something that can go out for some distance to test shipping lanes.
And like it says, it only takes 2 to 3 minutes to fly through the ship, fly through the plume of the ship, not fly through the ship. And we'll have a picture of the Skeldar V-200 drone, which is maritime ready, which looks like a traditional helicopter without a cockpit. It's got a sensor underneath that would be using it to sniff out the fumes. Now, it's a lot like doing whale snot, if we go back to the good old days that we've discovered. Going 10 miles offshore means that you can get the data before the ship comes in port, which is really cool. But, you know, us Dutch, we've been thinking about this kind of stuff all these years, you know, all those years of nautical sailing and being perpetually underwater. We got this down to a science,
I guess. This particular drone that at least is being used in some instances, this V-200 drone, it's pretty good size too. This is not your small little, quadcopter sized or RC helicopter sized drone. The rotor diameter is 15 feet. It's got a 4.2 foot height. The airframe length is 13 feet. And it's heavy. Its maximum takeoff weight is 518 pounds. So this is a large aircraft, and it's got quite an endurance too, over 5 hours in some cases. So it's. I think this is another good example of using the new technology, the capabilities of relatively low cost drones. I'm not sure that the V-200 is particularly cheap, but as a way to, enforce these new regulations that apply to ships emitting pollutants. So that's great.
And folks, he left out one statistic because he didn't want to admit it. But it flies off of Jet A or standard avgas. So no fuel cells for this one. So, but we'll move on. we knew this was coming, sort of. I was really sort of surprised the in-depth detail it has, but this is from amp.cnn.com. U.S. Department of Homeland Security issues an alert and has strong concerns that Chinese-made drones are stealing data. And we know where all of the drones are made as far as commercial or semi-commercial or whatever you want to call them. That would be DJI.
Yeah, now DJI continues to say that it gives customers, quote, full and complete control over how their data is collected, stored, and transmitted. And while the DHS is not prohibiting absolutely use of Chinese-made drones, they do have some precautions that they think people should take. And DJI says that customers can enable all the precautions that the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, recommends. So I don't know. It has come up before in the past. There have been some studies in the past that have looked at the data that's transmitted and if the operator has the ability to, restrict or limit the data to what they're willing to give up. But I don't know. I mean, we're as we record this, we're kind of in the middle of a budding trade war with China. So it's kind of hard to ascertain, at least in my opinion, just exactly what's going on here and just exactly what the threat is or isn't. So I guess everybody has to kind of take the advice of the Department of Homeland Security and make your own decision.
Yeah, and it definitely has a political component. I forget what the name of the other organization is, but the main tech company for cell phones has also been under scrutiny from DHS. So we still like DJI. We'd like them to come on the show. Brendan, you're welcome to come on the show anytime you want. But it is part of the world we live in, and DJI it's got the biggest bullseye on it. So speaking of bullseyes or baskets or NASCAR hoops, I thought this was kind of cool, Max, because, you know, we've touched animals, but we haven't really, and we've had the Olympics, but we haven't talked about major league sports. But evidently, they've weighed into the FAA on the NPRM.
That's right, through the commenting process. So what we have here is the NFL, MLB, NASCAR, and the NCAA, all major league sports organizations here in the U.S., and they've tossed their comments into the hat. They've expressed some concerns, and they have a couple of them. They want to see rules that explicitly state that UAS operations at night comply with rules that are applicable to aircraft. But the next concern they have, I think, is kind of more interesting. They want to see the requirement that pilots make their credentials available to law enforcement. They want that expanded to include private security officials. And I think this kind of makes a lot of sense, because at these major sporting events in stadiums and so forth, a lot of times, if not almost all the time, for large events, the security is provided by, sure, law enforcement to a small extent, but to a much greater extent by private security officials. And so these leagues want to see those kinds of officials, the private security officials, have the authority to ask you for your drone credentials. What do you think, David?
I don't know. I don't think there's a problem with that, because you go anywhere, and Max and I know, being media, you prominently wear your credentials out in the open so everybody can see it. I don't see why a drone operator wouldn't do the same thing. Stadiums have their own security forces. Likewise, NASCAR tracks have their own security. So they are the law. So therefore, I don't know why the FAA wouldn't want to comply with this. They also want to institute remote identification requirements for all types and sizes of UAS, speed up the designation of sensitive facilities like no-fly zones for UAS. And this is all because of what happened at the Super Bowl. It was a giant no-fly zone, but there was a lot of people who needed to be grounded, huh, Max?
Yeah, the numbers in here, I don't recall seeing in the past, and they're a lot larger than I was aware of. The article points out that at the Super Bowl this year in 2019, more than 50 UAS operations were observed, and 38 drones were seized for violating flight restrictions. Now, that's a big number. It's a lot of drones up in the air around the stadium. And it, equally impressive is the number that they were able to seize, 38 of them. I think that's pretty impressive. So clearly it's a problem that's large. I think it's great that organizations like these leagues are weighing in with their comments and concerns. And, you know, that's part of what this NPRM process is all about, is to get comments from stakeholders, comments from the public, comments from organizations that are impacted. And these things really are dialed into the FAA's rulemaking process. At least that's what we've seen in the past. So it's encouraging to see other groups get involved in the conversation. It contributes to having better rules, better regulations in the end.
You know, and the best part about it is we know that these organizations want drones. You know, they're going out of their way so they can bring drones in and use them for the benefit of their audiences. You know, I can't wait till the first F1 race is documented by drones, or it'll be interesting to see with us having Memorial Day coming up this weekend, Super Sunday, where we have Monaco and we have the Indianapolis 500 and we have the Coca-Cola 600 at night. So it'll be interesting how the drones participate in those racing activities. Looking forward to all that beautiful drone footage, to paraphrase Bush's baked beans, on this barbecue weekend. Roll that beautiful drone footage. Well, our next story comes from our director of wildlife. Not necessarily a wildlife thing, but something I don't think we've talked about, which is states turn to drones to protect avalanches. This is from APN News. The American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials found all but one state public transportation agency was now using drones. Rhode Island wasn't, but now they've since bought one. But what was interesting, I thought, in the article was surveying the avalanches is usually done by helicopter. Helicopter makes noise. And what sets off avalanches? Noise.
That's right.
Drones are quieter and more able to observe. They can observe so they can do preventative explosions or avalanches, because the best way to control an avalanche is to set it off when you know it's going off. So it's not often we talk about drones being quiet and that being an effective tool for something like this.
There was a interesting statistic, interesting to me anyway, in here also that 36 states now have certified drone pilots on staff. That's a pretty high number. I guess the rest of the states that employ drones are using some kind of a service rather than having, you know, state employees who are certified drone pilots. I'm curious to see how that changes over time, whether or not it makes sense for a state to, you know, employ a group of drone pilots or to outsource that in effect to an outside company. But certainly there's a lot of activity at the state levels for drones to be used in a whole lot of different kinds of circumstances. And yeah, avalanches is one, spotting wildlife, doing inspections, all kinds of applications. The states and the U.S. have really jumped on this.
So our next story is from our drone-loving compatriot on Airplane Geeks and SR-71 expert. I think you should leave that in just for humor's sake. SR-20 SR22 expert, Max Trescott. And this was from NOAA. Researchers test unmanned aircraft systems for measuring lower atmosphere, potentially improving short-term weather forecasts. We just had some devastating tornadoes here in the States as we record this. So NOAA's trying to get ahead of the game, and low pressure means tornadoes. So using and we've talked about this previously in a couple of episodes back, but it's starting to get more and more concrete that NOAA and the National Weather Service want to use drones so they can get even more early warning.
And this is a project that's with the National Severe Storms Laboratory, which is under NOAA, but also with the University of Oklahoma, the University of Colorado, and a company called Metromatics. And they're using some Metromatics rotary drones in this study. Also, University of Oklahoma is providing a rotary UAS, a copter sonde. And the University of Colorado is working with their T-Twister. That's a fixed-wing UAS.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I got to admit, though, I liked T-Twister fixed-wing, although I kind of originally read that as T-toddling or T-toting. But T-Twister is kind of cool. And there was a press conference on May 12th. We'll have to follow up on that. But it's been very cool the way, you know, I don't normally think of tornadoes and aircraft, but UAVs are becoming a great way to provide early warning for them. So, Max, we got a video of the week. This video I found, but evidently this is one of those videos that everybody found. Thanks to Isaac and our Slack listener team for providing it. But this was really cool, but I like stingrays and stingrays are always really cool because they're the av geeks of the ocean.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? Come to think of it. So this video came from off the coast of Australia, where a huge group of stingrays were swimming like in a flock. It was almost kind of a bird-like flock. At least that's what came to my mind.
Well, you could always say it was a school of fish.
Well, that too, but just the way, I don't know, the way it moved as a group was, it just reminded me of birds. Plus, you know, they're sort of flapping and they're more bird-like than fish-like, I guess. But in any event, you know, they're just below the surface, so the drone up above it has got a great view of this group, this school, this flock of stingrays swimming. Pretty impressive. We'll have a link to a piece that's got the video embedded. We'll have that in the show notes.
So, Max, we could always look at it this way. All of that flapping actually is applause for the way we do this show every week. Even the rays like splashing around when they hear the UAV digest. So how's that for our takeaway from the video of the week?
It's not what I was expecting, that's for sure. That's pretty good. All right. Well, we want to thank you for listening to the UAV Digest. This has been episode 288. So if you want to go straight to the show notes, of course, that's at the uavdigest.com/288. Otherwise, you'll find show notes for all of the episodes at the uavdigest.com. And we encourage you to take a look there. You'll find links to all the stories we talk about, links to the companies we talk about, the videos, and all of it. So visit the webpage when you get a chance.
So with that, you can always find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UAV Digest. You can become part of our Slack listener team, and you do that by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. And of course, if you find some stories that you like, send it to us. And last but not least, you can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Happy Memorial Day weekend in your states. Otherwise, have a good weekend, and we'll see you next weekend.